Here we go. Tonight we have the wonderful opportunity to learn about Unculus. Who here knows a lot about Unculus? One hand. Ah, can always count on you.
Not a lot.
Not a lot. A little bit. Hey? The answer is neither did I. The answer is prior to preparing this class, I knew a little bit about Unculus, and I'll tell you as we go along what I knew. But I really didn't understand Unculus. I didn't understand his methodology. I didn't understand the context in which he was writing. So that's what we're going to do tonight. Tonight is going to be, we actually know very little biographic information about Unculus, and we'll get into a little bit about why that's so confusing for us. So what I'm going to do the bulk of the time is, because usually while I try to spend so much time on the history of it, tonight we're going to focus a lot on the methodology of Unculus, and I'm going to make it as easy as possible.
How do you spell his name?
O-N-K-E-L-O-S. Hey? And this is going to be easier than putting together an IKEA chair. That's my money back guarantee. Hey? Before we get to Unculus, when you open up a Chumash, and you go to read Unculus, how would you tell someone you were going to read it? It's called? Targum Unculus. What does the word Targum mean? Targum means to translate. So before I actually get to Unculus, I want to talk for a minute about translation. Because you can't really understand Unculus until you understand the historical context of why the Torah needed to be translated. Think about it this way. If Moshe received the Torah at Har Sinai, and he gave that Torah to Yoshua, and Yoshua to the Zakenim, and the Zakenim to the to the Nevi'im, and the Nevi'im to the Anshei Knesset Agdola, at what point in Jewish history did there come a need for translation? Okay. So actually it all begins back about 4 years ago in our discussion of Tanakh B'Shana and in my class on Ezra Nechemi, and I am sure you all remember it like it was yesterday. Well, toward the end of Nehemiah, and I hope this AC goes down so I can stop yelling, but towards the end of, I can turn it off but then we'll all sweat. Towards the end of Nehemiah is describing the decrepit nature spiritually of the Jewish people. And he describes mass intermarriage. And in the context of that conversation, he says the following. Gam b'yamim ahem ra'isi es ha-yehudim ha-shivu nashim ha-shtadiyot amaniyot moaviyot. In these days, Nehemiah says, I see all the nice, young, innocent Jewish ladies. I'm sorry, the Jews are marrying women from other tribes, called intermarriage. Pasuk 24. Ubineim chatzi medaber ashdodios ve'ena makirim ledaber yehudis v'chilshon am v'am. In the time of Nehemiah makes sense. What historical time period is Nehemiah writing in? It's the end of which exile? End of the first exile. Again, Ezra Nehemiah is when Koresh gives the Jewish people the right to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. They've now been in exile for how many years? 70 some odd, right? Those who are taking the Daniel class on Tuesday mornings, we're going to get to that in a few weeks, the whole nature of the 70-year exile. Okay? So the Jewish people have been in exile in Babel for 70 years. What happens when you've been in a foreign culture for 70 years? You take on their language and you forget your own. So Nehemiah reports that there are Jewish people who forgot how to speak Hebrew and were picking up the language of the other cultures that they were exposed to. But what happens if you forget Hebrew? What can you no longer learn? Torah. And that's exactly what happens. Again, Ezra and Nehemiah doesn't work in chronological order. So we're actually going back in Prakim, but ahead chronologically. Okay, Nehemiah chapter 8. This is where Ezra makes his appearance in Sefer Nehemiah. It's a little confusing. Ezra is, they find a Sefer Torah. And Ezra gathers all the people around, and they publicly read the Torah. Very similar to what tradition that we have every 7 years? Hakel, right? So he brings everyone together. And the Pasuk says, Ve'asfu kol am ki ish echad el rachov. So he brings everyone together into Times Square. Okay? Asher lifnei sharamayim, right before the gate of water. Vayomru le'ezra sofer, la'avi et sefer Torah, Moshe asher tziva Adonai es Yisrael. So they ask Ezra to please read for them the Torah. By Avi Ezra Kohen as a Torah lifnei Kahal meish vadisha What day is this? What's the first day of the seventh month? Rosh Hashanah. So it's on Rosh Hashanah, they're sitting in Times Square, and Ezra brings the Sefer Torah, and man, woman, child, everyone's coming together. He starts reading the Torah, min hayor, which means from the daylight until midday. So he's just going. Right? We had a speaker here last Shabbos, 2 weeks ago. She pressed an on button, right, Eve Harrow, and she just went. So that's what Ezra did. Ezra pushed on, and he just started reading the Torah. Okay? And so he's reading. Right? You skip down to the last pasuk. Vayikru'u b'sefer Torah Elokim. So he's reading the Torah of Hashem. Miforash v'som seichel, which again, what som means, like you place, seichel means your mind. V'yavinu b'mikra, and they understood the language. The Gemara says that's a bizarre phraseology. What does that mean? That they paid attention? They weren't paid? What is this talking about? So the Gemara in Megillah tells us, Amarav, Mai dichsiva vayikru b'sefer Torah se'okim b'forash v'som seichel v'yavinu b'mikra. What is that last pasuk talking about? That they paid attention. So it says, vayikru b'sefer Torah se'okim z'mikra. When it says that they read the Torah of Hashem, that refers to the actual text. The word miforash means zet targum. It means that as Ezra is reading this Torah, people couldn't understand it. The Jewish people spiritually were in a terrible state. And so because they couldn't understand it, they would have Stuart Silverman standing up there reading the Torah, and they would have Josh Hirschberg standing next to him explaining what it is that they were reading. What language was he explaining it in? Presumably Aramaic, right? That's the language of the time, okay? And as the Rambam writes in his Hilchos Tefillah, Mi'emos Ezra, from the time of Ezra, referring to that last pasuk that we just described, Sheyehesham Torgman mitargein la'am Masha Kore Kore b'Torah Kedeshia Vinu Inyan Hadvarim. The Rambam says that from the time of Ezra, Nehemiah, from that time period, they always had a translator up there. So that as the Baal Kore would be reading the Torah, there would be someone standing with them to translate the Torah. Rambam continues, I'm translating, but there's a halacha that you can only read one pasuk at a time. Because you want to make sure that the Meturgaman, the one explaining and translating, doesn't lose anything in translation. That they have to open up, that they have an opportunity to keep up. Okay? You think Torah reading is long in our shul? Imagine what it must have been like back in the times of Ezra Nehemiah. Read a pasuk, translate. Read, translate. Doubles the time. Okay? And that's what happened. In fact, you see throughout the Gemara, in almost many cases, when it talks about public Torah reading, it includes a meturgaman, it includes a translator. Because that what was always done. If you remember back to previous years, I think this was 2 years ago, the first year of People of the Book, when I taught about Midrash, so this is the foundation of Midrash. In other words, this ultimately morphed into what we would nowadays call a drasha, which was an attempt to translate the Torah for the masses and to make it accessible and understandable for people. It all starts in the time of Nehemiah when the people no longer understand the Torah. Okay? And that's where we get this notion of Targum from. That's where we get this notion of translating the Torah. Is translation a good thing? So I share with you an English translation of a comment by the Chassam Sofer. But the Chassam Sofer writes that he is not such a fan of translation into other languages. Why not? So he writes, the translation of the Torah into Greek or into any other language is bad and bitter. Since the Torah is written in a language that God spoke to Moshe, it is like a hammer shattering a stone. And every verse contains multiple interpretations. No matter what pshat interpretation one gives, the text can bear alternative interpretations. This is why we never run out of things to say on Shabbos. Right? Whatever you say, I'll find something else to say. There are endless opportunities to explain the Torah. Jews must therefore listen to the words of the rabbis, their commentaries, commentators, and their hermeneutical rules. This cannot be done with the translation of the Torah into another language, for the translator must choose a single literal interpretation and render it into that language, because the languages of the nations do not bear the same multiple meanings. Says the Chasam Sofer that Torah, Hebrew, purposefully is ambiguous. And the reason why the Hebrew in the Torah is purposefully ambiguous is to make sure that we never get bored of it. That every year when you go back to learn the Parsha, or every year when you go back to learn something in Chumash, it's going to be fresh to you. You're going to find new interpretations. And that's based on the fact that purposefully, by design, says the Chasam Sofer, every word carries multiple connotations. Every word can be interpreted different ways, many of which we're going to see tonight. Says the Chasam Sofer, when you translate that into English, or when you translate that into Greek, which I don't know, but other people do, and when you translate that into Aramaic, it's a whole new set of rules. English has, although obviously certain words have multiple definitions, says the Chasam Sofer, it's different than Hebrew. And therefore he argues that translation is not a good thing. And in fact, this is why the Megillat Tanit, which we don't have nowadays, or is not applicable nowadays, Megillat Tanit, we really only read about on Hanukkah time and Purim time. And the reason is because Megillat Tanit lists a couple of hundred fastings, or days you couldn't say Tachanun, or days you couldn't do a eulogy, none of which are applicable anymore nowadays, which is why we don't study it. But in Megillat Tanit, it records that the day the Torah was translated into Greek was a fast day. And it remained that way for generations and generations. Because it was considered basically the loss of all that, the minutia that's within the psukim, the lines in between the lines of the Torah, was all lost, the rabbis felt, when it was translated into Greek. And therefore, they established that as a fast day. So tragic was it that it was translated into a foreign language, right? It's interesting for us to think about. Because nowadays, we have access to unprecedented translation. Literally in the history of the world, in the history of Torah, Jews have never had, en masse, such access to religious texts. Gemara, Chumash, Navi, Midrash, everything is now translated by art scrolls, since, you know, something. But says the Chasam Sofer, don't forget, you lose something. You lose something when you only read the translation and don't read and involve yourself in the nitty-gritty of the Pasuk itself. Okay? Translation is difficult for other reasons as well. One more thing. What about Aramaic? So Aramaic is a little bit different, as we'll see tonight. And that is that the Bereishis Rabba writes, Amar of Shmuel Bar Nachman, Al Yehei Lashon Farsi Azeh Kal Beinecha, Shebetorah V'Nevim K'suv Masinu Shehakadosh Baruch Hu Cholek Lo Kavod. He says, don't think that Aramaic language should be taken lightly. Why? Because we see that Aramaic appears in Torah, Nevi'im, and Ksuvim as well. Okay? And I cut off the examples, you'll trust me. It appears in Torah, I think the word is Shadusa, right? There are three or four words in the Torah. Ksuvim we know, because we're learning all of Sefer Daniel. A few words appear in Nevi'im. So says the Bereishis Rabba, Aramaic can't be that bad, because God himself puts Aramaic into the Torah. Okay? And well, obviously we're going to be speaking about tonight is Aramaic. So if Aramaic is okay, translation bad, Aramaic comes along, Bereishis Rabba, and says, maybe not so bad. But translation even to Aramaic is going to be tricky. Okay? No translation is perfect. Now I just want to give you two examples. Okay? And I could have we could sit here all night giving examples. I'm just giving you a couple of tidbits for each one because I want to give you a flavor for it. So example number one is a pasuk in Sefer Bereishis. Vayomer Adam, Zos Hapam Etzem Me'atzamai, Basar Mibsari, Lazos Yikarei, Isha, Ki Me'ish Lukachazo. Adam Arishon finds a wife, right? A wife is born to him. He says, this is from my flesh and my bones. And therefore he says, I will call her Isha, Ki Me'ish, because she comes from me, a man. Now, if you're reading the Hebrew, that makes perfect sense. The whole point is woman came from man. And so therefore the term for woman is going to be very similar to the term for man. Parenthetically, the English language does the same thing. I'm sure there's some Greek and Latin significance to this. My mom would know it, I don't. Right? But woman and man, right? The same word appears in woman that appears in man. Similar to Isha and Ish. Now, watch what happens for those who didn't cheat. When we, and I'm going to call you cheaters all night, watch what happens when we sneak ahead to the Aramaic. And you'll notice that you lose that, I don't even know what the correct, I'm looking for a nuance. Word here. The what?
Nuance.
Nuance, thank you. The nuance of the pasuk. Forget everything else. First of all, every time you see red tonight, that's going to be Aramaic. That's going to be our code word. Okay? So, the Amar Adam Hadazimna Garme Migarme of Isra Mibsari Ladayis Kare. Therefore I will call, like Kara, Itita. Itita in Aramaic means
Isha.
Are Mibala Nisivada. Okay? Now you notice here, Ish and Isha are very similar. Itita and Baala are not similar at all. So whatever nuanced idea the Torah is trying to connect for us is lost in the Aramaic translation. So even though Aramaic is eons ahead, says the Bereishis Rabbah, of other translations, it's still not going to be perfect. I'll give you another example. Next, two psukim later, Adam and Chava have eaten from the wrong tree. Okay? Vayushneim arumim ha'adam v'ishto v'lo yisposhashu. The pasuk tells us they eat from the tree. What do they realize? They're not wearing any clothes. Whoopsies. Right? So what do? So they were not embarrassed. The very next pasuk, the Torah tells us, V'hanachash hayu arum mikol chayat hasadeh. Well, what does arum mean there? Does it mean naked? No, what does it mean?
Cunning,
clever. Now, I didn't write the Torah. But it's very clear that the Torah uses the same word as a double entendre, right? One time to mean naked, one time to mean clever, but it's clearly drawing a connection for us. Because of Nachash's cleverness and cunningness, they are now realize they're naked and aren't embarrassed about it. Okay, so there's a direct correlation. What happens when you translate into Aramaic? So the Aramaic for Arumim here is Artila'in, Artila'in, and here it's Chachim, from like Chacham. Okay? So whatever nuance they want us to understand here is completely lost when you translate into Aramaic. Okay, so while Aramaic is still far above anything else, no translation is going to be perfect. Okay? Second thing to know about translation is that no matter how hard you translate a pasuk, literally, it is impossible to do so. There's no such thing as a literal translation. Translation, by definition, almost 90% of the time, involves some form of commentary as well. Okay? In fact, if you read Art Scroll sometimes, right? I'll use this in a drasha sometimes, where I'll say Art Scroll understands it one way, but Art Scroll looks at all of the Mefarshim and they have to pick one parish. Most of the time, it's going to be Rashi, and they're going to translate it that way. Now, that's not a literal translation. That is taking Rashi and using that as a translation. But that is not a literal translation. It's very hard to literally translate words into another language. They don't always translate perfectly. So I'll give you an example. The pasuk says here, this is, I think, the most difficult pasuk in the Torah. So if you ask me what the pasuk's really talking about, I have no clue. Okay? This is after who sins?
Cain.
Cain, right? Cain's about to kill his brother. So the pasuk says, Hashem says to Cain, "Halo im titiv se'eit, if you improve se'eit," what does se'eit mean? I got no clue, which is why I didn't translate it, right? "Vimlo se'eitiv lepesach chatat roveitz," and if you don't improve, if you don't, right? So then, lepetach chatat roveitz means sin crouches at the door, which is not even a literal translation. "Ve'elecha teshukato ve'atatim shalbo," it's going to rule over you. Okay, according to most Mefarshim, this pasuk is talking about the Yitzhara, the evil inclination. Okay? Now what does this word se'eit mean? So we have no idea. From reading the Hebrew, you have no clue what it means. Listen to how Unkelus translates it. Unkelus says, "Halo im totev uvadach," okay, "yishtabek lach," which means, is it not true that if you improve your actions, it will be forgiven for you? Se'eit, according to Unklus means it will be forgiven for you. Now that's not what actually Seid means. Seid can mean many things, but I'm not sure why literally it means it will be forgiven for you. What Unklus is doing is taking a very difficult pasuk and explaining it to us. He's making it relatable to us. That by definition is not a literal translation. That by definition is commentary. Okay? Listen to how the Malbim, I'll just give you an example, how the Malbim interprets our exact same pasuk. I'm sorry, the purple was my daughter. She was, instead of reading her a book last night, we were doing my PowerPoint, so she got to pick some of the colors. Let's say you're lucky that the red didn't turn into pink. That's what it was supposed to be, okay? So he writes here the following. Ki bein im teitiv se'et, ubein im lo teitiv ha'ma se'et, ein bazeh shumala achar shalapetach hatat rovet. Before I translate, how does Malbim use the word se'et? No longer means it will be forgiven for you. What does it mean? It means your gift. Se'et means a gift, according to the Malbim. And so the pasuk reads, whether your im teitiv se'et, whether your gift is good, or whether it's not good, ein bazeh shumala. It's not going to help you. Why? Because the evil inclination is going to get the better of you. Now that is a dramatically different interpretation than Unklus. And therefore, what I'm trying to show is that no matter what, by trying to translate something, you are automatically giving that thing commentary. And that is part of the reason why translation is so complicated. Okay. Who is Unklus? Well, none of us really knew anything about him coming in. So I could tell you anything and you'll have to believe me. Okay? And in fact, we have no exact information concerning his identity. Okay? We have a scholar in our community, Dr. Israel Drazen, who has written, I think he's up to 25 books about Unklus, many scholarly articles about it. I'm not going to get into it so much, but I will leave it at this. According to Dr. Drazen, Unklus must have lived around the year 400 CE. He uses that because Unklus is found in the Gemara, which means he must be post-Midrash. He pins together a lot of his statements. Okay, so let's say somewhere around 400 CE. Okay? What do we know from the rabbis about Unklus? And this is where we're going to go to our source sheet. So if you look on source sheet, which is the one with the Gemara on the front, to page number one. Now, historically, it is unclear whether the Unklus, bless you, in our Gemaras is the Unklus in our translation. We don't know. Most scholars assume not. Most Meforshim assume yes. I am neither a scholar or a Perish, which is why I give you both. Okay? Scholars say 400 CE, they assume that he wasn't the Unklus that's in the Gemara, but classic Meforshim assume that it is the guy in the Gemara, so we're going to learn about him. What do we know about Unklus? Well, we know he's a convert. Okay, if you look in the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, we'll just read the English. Unklus, the son of Cleonimus, converted to Judaism. Caesar sent a troop of Romans after him, Mashkinu Bekrai. But Unklus enticed them by reciting Psukim to them. Right? He wowed them with Torah. A Gaier in these troops that were sent by Caesar, they converted to Judaism. Hadar Shadar Gunda de Rome Achrina da Basre. So Caesar sends another group of Romans. Amar Le, and Caesar says to them, Love Tamer Le Belomidi. Right? Don't talk to this guy. He's smooth talking. He's going to talk to you until you're numb and you're just going to say whatever you want, I'll agree to you. So, Kiavi Shaklu Azli. So as they were taking Unklus away, Amar Lahu, Eima Lachi Milsa Be'alma, can I tell you something? Right, not important, insignificant. Now I'm just going to read this in English. The Nifiora holds a torch in front of the Pifiora. These are different types of, like the general and the sergeant and the colonel. That's basically what these terms are. The Pifiora in front of the Duxa in front of the Kegma, the Hegmona, and the Hegmona in front of the king. Right, so this is the equivalent of, you have the Capitol Police, then you have the Secret Service, then you have the armed guards, then you have the protective detail, and then you have the president. And that's what he's describing. In other words, you have layers of protection before you get to the king. Kuma mi naka nura mikame inchi. Now, he says, would it ever fathom you, would it ever be fathomable that the king would take a torch and go out in front of the people? Right? Would President Obama ever serve as the go in front of his Secret Service agents? So says the Gemara, Amri Le Lo, that's ridiculous. Right? The whole point of the protection is for the president to be behind. He's not going to go in front. Amar Lehu, Unkelus says back to him, HaKadosh Baruch Hu Naka Nora Kame Yisrael, but our God, He took the flame and went out in front of the Jewish people. As the Pasuk says, this is by the story of the splitting of the sea, Vashem Holech Lifnehem Yomam, that God went before them with a cloud and at night with fire. Igayir Kulu, so after smooth talking them, wowing them, they also converted to Judaism. Well, Caesar tried a third try. He sends another troop. Amr Lahu, he says to them, Lo tishtau midi behade. He says, don't even talk. Don't listen. Don't talk. Go handcuff him and bring him out to the gate. Right? Get rid of him. Ki naktu levi asli. So as they were taking him away, chazam mezuzasim. So, Uncle Asi is a mezuzah on the doorpost. Osip yadei Allah. He puts his hand. The Amr Lahu, and he says to them, my high. He says, what's this funny thing sitting on the door? So Amrulay, they say to him, Eima lanat. They say, we're Romans, right? We don't know what this is. Hey, you tell us what this is. So Amrulay, so Amrulahu, he says back to them, in Hago Shalolam, usually what happens is, Melech Basar Adam Yosheh Bifnim Ve'avada Mishamrim Oso Bechutz. The president sits on the inside of the White House, in the protective detail, sits on the outside of the White House. However, V'ilu HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but our God, Mishamran B'Bechutz, God protects us on the outside, and that's the purpose of a mezuzah. The purpose of a mezuzah is to serve as a form of protection. Egayer, so they too converted to Judaism. To Lo Shadar Basrei, and Caesar stopped sending people to take, right? He learned his lesson. He realizes they're not going to be successful, and he stops sending people to Unkelus. Okay? That's Gemara number one. We learn from this Gemara that Unkelus was a convert, and we learn that he was an effective convert, right? He was a Rabbi Brody before there was ever a Rabbi Brody, right? He was really good at converting people. Second Gemara that we know about, an equally famous Gemara, is recorded in Maseches Gittin. There the Gemara says, don't start where I have your arrow. I just did that to confuse you. Go down to the next paragraph where it says the Gemara cites related incident. Okay? Page 2. Okay? And you'll all notice, I now have a new pet peeve, which is back, front and back pages. Okay, because I find people get very confused. So you'll forgive me for killing a dozen more trees, but at least it'll be easy for everyone to follow along. Okay? So says the Gemara, Uncleus, who is the son of Colonicus and the son of Titus' sister? Now that is not correct. Mephorshim explained that it's really Hadrian, not Titus. But nonetheless, okay, so Uncleus comes from Yichus. Okay? So he wants to convert to Judaism. So he wants to convert to Judaism. He went and raised the spirit of Titus through necromancy. Okay. Amar Lai, Uncle says to Titus, Man Chashiv Bahal Alma, who is prominent in the world to come? So he answers, Yisrael, the Jewish people. Mahu li'idabuke bahu. Uncle says, should I idabuke, like to attach? Should I attach myself to them? Amarle milayu nefishin velo matzis l'kiyuminu. Says, nah, their laws are too many. You're never going to be able to do all them. Don't bother. What should you do instead? Go and attack them in that world. The Habe Ration, you will become a leader, as the Pasuk says. Ayutzarel LaRosh. The Pasuk says that the ones who persecute the Jewish people will become leaders themselves. He said, don't convert, go and persecute them. Amar lei, Uncle says, Tine dahau gavra b'mai, you, my dear friend, what is your punishment in the world to come? Like, what's life like for you, Titus, in the next world? Amar lei, Titus answers back, b'mai depasik anapshin, right? I get what I deserve. And that's where the previous Gemara that we didn't start, but basically Titus had him sprinkle his ashes all over the seven seas. And so says, Titus, that's what happens to me every day. Every day they gather my ashes, I'm rejudged again, and every day they scatter my ashes. It appears to be a very painful and difficult experience. So Onkelos realizes he's not going to get chizuk from Titus. So he goes to another winner of an anti-Semite. He goes to Bilam. Azal aske le Bilam benegida. So he comes to Bilam, wakes him up to Amalei man chashibau alma. He says, Mr. Bilam, who is chashav in that next world? Who is prominent in the world to come? Amalei, Bilam answers, Yisrael. So again, malid buke bahu. Should I connect myself to them? Should I convert? Amar lei lo tidro shlomam v'tomasam kol yamim. Right? Seek neither their peace nor their benefit all the days. In other words, stay away. So Amar lei unkelos, Mr. Bilam, what's life like for you in the world to come? So Amar lei, Bilam answers back, b'shichvat zera rotachas, I am punished in boiling semen. I have never experienced that. But one need not use too much imagination to assume that that is not a pleasant experience. Why that imagery is used, you'll see in footnote number 3 if you'd like to see. Again, Bilam tried to entice the Jewish people through promiscuity, through getting them to the Moabite women to entice them and to sleep with them. So his punishment is that he's going to forever boil in hot semen. Okay. So Uncleus strikes out again. So he goes, and he went and raised the sinner of Israel again. We don't know who that sinner is, but Laposha Israel, the sinners of Israel. And again he asks, who is prominent in the world to come? They say again, Israel. Mali debuke, but who should I join them? Amrelei, tovasam drosh, rasam lo chidrosh. Seek their benefit, do not seek their harm. In other words, right? Maybe they aren't so bad. Whoever touches them is like one who touches the pupil of his eye. In other words, whoever harms the Jewish people, he himself is harmed. Okay? Amar lei, dinai da'u gavra b'mai. Again, what is your punishment in the world to come? Amar lei, bitsoa rosachas. He is boiling in feces. Okay? As it says, da'amar mar, kol hamali gal divrei chachamim, Nidon bitsoa rotachas. Anyone who mocks the words of the sages is punished in boiling feces. Okay, very nice. That's the end of our Gemara. So again, what do we see? We see Onkelos as the convert. We see Onkelos as a seeker, someone who's seeking out what Judaism is, whether it's worthwhile to attach oneself to the Jewish people. We see that Onkelos has yichus, according to the Gemara, that he comes from Hadrian, he comes from greatness, he comes from the emperors themselves. And as we saw in the previous Gemara, we see that he converted to Judaism and brought other people over as well. And that's why he is part of our converts of the book. Okay. Now let's go into Targum Onkelos. Back to our PowerPoint. We are going to identify tonight 7 identifying characteristics of Targum Onkelos. Now, I am not a biblical scholar. I am not a scholar. As I always say, I only know what I read. And I happen to have come across a magnificent article by a friend of our communities, Dr. Avigail Rock, who has a gorgeous article about Onkelos. And I will admit openly and proudly that much of these 7 items, although not all, but much of it, is gleaned from her article. So I give her full credit. She is the scholar. I am the thief, I guess. Or the funnel, to funnel it to you. Okay? But again, a lot of this is from her article. It's really a beautiful article. Okay. Characteristic number 1. Onkelos is, to the best of his ability, a terse, literal, and simple translation. We're going to outline the 7 and then go one by one. Okay? Number 2. And this is a major one. Unculus avoids the anthropomorphization, which is not a word, according to spell check, but I think it's an actual word, okay? He will avoid anything that creates human characteristics of God, and we're going to spend a lot of time on that tonight. Number three, he explains the significance of metaphors in the Torah. Sometimes we'll read metaphors in the Torah, we have no clue why the Torah is employing those metaphors. Unculus is going to not only translate them, but he's going to explain them. Number four, biblical poetry. Right? Biblical poetry is not meant to be understood literally, like any poetry. Biblical poetry, more often than not, is meant to represent something about something prophetic. Okay? I'll give you an example. Az Yashir. Okay? Yashir is in what tense? Future tense. But they are singing in the present. So why is it written in the future tense? The Gemara in the end of Masechet Sanhedrin has many pages how Yashir is talking about Tchiyas HaMeisim, the revival of the dead. And in fact, the Gemara says that's how we see the revival of the dead in the Torah. Okay? Now again, that's poetic in the Torah, but it represents something prophetic. And we're going to see again more about that as we go through. Number five, Unculus attempts to prevent errors that may lead to Chil HaShem. We know, this is no secret, that our enemies throughout history have tried to use the terminology in the Torah to prove things that are heretical to our belief system. So Unculus, in his translation, tries to erase those things which can be misunderstood so that the nations of the world cannot misconstrue it. Number six, he strives to maintain the dignity of our forefathers. We're going to talk a lot about last week's Parsha and this week's Parsha. A lot of the Parshios, you left scratching your head and you're saying, wait a second, aren't our mothers and fathers, foremothers and forefathers, supposed to be righteous individuals? And yet we see them cheating and lying and stealing? What kind of model citizen is that? So Unculus, we're going to see, manipulates the terms to prevent us from ever having that conversation. And lastly, Targum and Halacha, Unculus will oftentimes, in his commentary, incorporate the Halacha into the Pasuk itself. Okay, and again, we'll see all of these. I'll give you an example that we're not going to see tonight. But the Pasuk says, if you hurt someone, rapo yerape, which means officially, rapo means heal. Now, we know that's not what the Pasuk means. The Pasuk, according to the Torah Shebaal Peh, Halacha, doesn't mean I have to heal the person. What do I have to do? I have to pay for his doctor's fees. And so Unculus, in his translation, says, you have to pay for the doctor's fee. He doesn't translate it as you have to heal the person. Again, he uses his targum, he uses his explanation, and incorporates halacha into it so that we actually understand the Torah. Again, targum means that you're understanding it. It wants to make it more relatable to the people around. Okay, let's go one by one. Literal translation. The pasuk says, "Vatera ha'isha ki tov ha'etz l'machal." Who wants to translate that for me without cheating? Right. This is talking about Chava. Vatera ha'isha. Chava sees, the woman sees, ki tov ha'etz l'machal, that the tree is good to eat. Listen to how Unculus translates it. V'chaza itata. Chazat means to see. Itata means the woman. Are tov, that it was good. Ilana l'meichal. Basically a word for word translation. Now that's significant because, let's take Rashi for example. Does Rashi always employ a literal translation? What does Rashi use a lot? Well, he's going to use Targum, but what does he use a lot? I heard in the back something. Midrash, he uses Midrash. And in fact, if you look at the Targum Yerushalmi, which we're not talking about tonight, but it's another one of these Targums, listen to how they translate this pasuk. And the woman perceived Samael, the angel of death. What is that talking about? Now again, I don't want to get into why the Targum is writing that. But I want to show you that whereas other commentaries will more often than not incorporate midrash or wild ideas into their explanation, Unculus, when appropriate, will try to stick to the pshat. And that's in fact what he does there. So again, I would say 80% of the time it attempts to be a literal translation. Whereas, and I just gave you an example of how others will use it. What about the anthropomorphization of God? So let's give an example. This is talking about Noah. Va'avayim zachar nekeva mikol basar, that male and female came from all the animals, kasher tzivah so alokim, as God commanded, va'yiskor Adonai ba'ado. Who wants to translate those last three words? Va'yiskor means to close. Adonai is God, ba'ado. So what is God doing? God is closing the doors. God is closing the doors to the table. Now wait a second. I have a problem with that. God is not a person. God doesn't have hands. God doesn't have feet. God doesn't have arms. How can God close a door? Right? So what does Unculus add? Just look at these last words. Vagain, which means protection. See, even that's a different translation. Adonai b'meimra. What does meimra mean? Through his utterance, we'll translate it. Through his word. Okay? So it's no longer God with physical qualities, even though, as we'll see, it gets a little tricky. Speeches are physical qualities. But through his utterances, I think it was a little better translation. Right? So God closes it b'meimra. Why does Unculus add the word b'meimra? Because it de-emphasizes God's physical qualities. God doesn't need a hand anymore. It's through his edict, through his utterance, that the door was closed. Okay? Give you another example. This is after the story of Noah. When Noah comes out of the Teva, and what does he offer up first and foremost? Sacrifice. And the Pasuk says, Vayarach Adonai es reach hanichoah. God, Yarach means smell, the pleasant smell. Vayomer Adonai alibo lo osif. And God says to his heart, I am no longer going to destroy you. Again, how can God say? So again, he adds in, Va'amar Adonai b'meimra, b'meimre. God said through his utterances. Okay? Which again, it de-emphasizes God actually speaking. Okay? And it adds in words to emphasize utterances or edicts or things like that and not physical qualities of God. I'll give you a couple more examples. Shmos. This is the end of Parshas Mishpatim. When right after the pasuk of Naaseh v'Nishma, the pasuk says Ve'latzili b'nei Yisrael lo shalach yad, that God did not do any harm. Okay, but how can God lo shalach yad? God doesn't have a hand. How can you tell me that God didn't send forth His hand? So says Unculus, lo have niska, there was no harm. There was no harm is very different than I took my arm and hurt you. Okay? One requires a physical activity on behalf of God. One does not. Okay. One more example. Or maybe two more. This is in Sefer Shmos, when the miracles are happening. Vayomer achar tumim el paro, the sorcerer say to Paro, Etzba Elokimi, this must be the finger of God. How can God have a finger? And so again, Unculus adds in, Macha min kadam Adonai. What's Macha? Macha means it is a plague. Okay? In other words, no longer is it God's hand, but it is a characteristic, or it's a quality, or it's a manifestation, or it's a result of God. But again, he takes out the word God's hand, because again, he wants to de-emphasize God's physical characteristics. And lastly, Erdana ve'erekta kasa ba'alai. Okay, God says, this is by what story? Story of Sodom. Right, God says, I'm going to go down. How can God go down? Right, that involves walking. That involves feet. God doesn't have feet. So therefore, Unculus translates it, Et galei ke'an ve'adom. I will reveal myself and judge. That's very different than I will go down. Revealing is different than physically doing something. Okay. Another example of where it avoids the anthropomorphization of God. Unculus will introduce intermediary terms. I'll give you an example. Pasuk says in Bereishis, Vahine Adonai Nitzav Alav. God stands above him. How can God stand above someone? Doesn't that imply that God has legs? Can't be. So again, Unculus adds in the word Vahayikara. Yikara means his glory. Right? So it's not God standing, but it is a characteristic of God. Again, that de-emphasizes God's physical characteristics. And I think this is my last example. We say every Friday night, and, right? Ki os hi, ki beini uvein b'nei Yisrael os hi le'olam. Talking about Shabbos. Between me and the Jewish people, this will be a sign. How can, we are physical, how can you equate God's physicality to our physicality? That can't happen. So again, he adds in a word. Bein meimri, that same word, meimra, meimri, between my utterance and you, this is going to be a symbol. So again, it de-emphasizes God's physical nature and emphasizes, and again, you'll see those words, meimri, yikra, you'll see those all the time used as filler words by unkelus. Again, to de-emphasize God's physical characteristics. Okay, why does unkelus do that? Why is it so important? Or I should say, why is it so problematic that God has a physical body, that God has a physical nature? So I want to explore three answers. This is actually a whole shiur in and of itself. And long before I knew I was teaching unkelus, I had filed away things to give a shiur about this for. The anthropomorphization of God. Okay? So let's just do this quickly. Number one is to avoid mistakes. Okay? To avoid misunderstanding of who God is and what God is not, lest someone think that God has a physical body. Now, I gave you a source here, but I ended up going to a different source because it's in English. So if you go to page 4 of your source sheet, this is from the Rambam's Mor Nevuchim. The Rambam loved unkelus, as we'll see from the flowery language. Rambam writes the following. Unkelus the proselyte was very perfect in the Hebrew and Syrian languages and directed his effort toward the abolition of the belief in God's corporeality. Hence, he interprets in accordance with its meaning every attribute that Scripture predicates of God and that might lead toward the belief in corporeality, right? It's a problem to assume God has a physical body. We don't want anyone to assume that. Thus, whenever he encounters one of the terms indicative of one of the kinds of motion, he makes a motion to mean the manifestation and appearance of a created light. I mean the indwelling or the action of the providence. Thus, he renders the Lord will descend by the words, the Lord will manifest itself. We've seen a couple of these. And the Lord descended by the words, and the Lord manifested itself. He does not translate, and the Lord came down. He also translates, I will descend and see you, but I will manifest myself now and see you. This occurs continually in his interpretation. That's a lot of what we've seen up until this point. Goes on the Rambam, last line of page 4. However, he does translate, I will descend with thee into Egypt. Okay, that is talking about when Yaakov is going down to Egypt to see Yosef. Okay, Hashem comes to him in a dream and says, I'm going to go down with him. And says the Rambam over there, unkelus doesn't add in any of these filler words. He leaves it as God is going down to Egypt. So wonders the Rambam, why over there doesn't unkelus change his mind? So he says, right, he leaves it by I will go down with thee to Egypt, top of page 5. And this is a very marvelous story that indicates the perfection of this distinguished man. Again, he's talking about unkelus. Listen to the flowery language. As well as the fine qualities of interpretation and of his understanding of the things as they really are. This translation also reveals to us an important matter regarding prophecy. For in the beginning of that story, right before Hashem tells him, I'm going to go down to Egypt, the Pasuk says, and God spoke to Israel, to Yaakov in the vision of night, and said, Yaakov, Yaakov, I am God, I will descend with you to Egypt. Now in the view of the fact that the beginning of the passage includes the statement that this happened in the visions of the night, unkelus did not think that it would be unseemly to conform wholly to the text in his rendering of what was said in the visions of the night. This was the correct procedure. What does that mean in English? It means the following. Again, every other instance, unkelus translates God's physical characteristics and manifests them into his appearance or his glory or his divine providence. Rambam says there's one example. That when Yaakov's going down to Egypt, unkelus leaves it as God comes down and speaks to Yaakov. How can God come down? That implies that God has feet. Asks the Rambam, why doesn't that bother unkelus? The same way every other instance bothered unkelus. And he says, because Unculus was a very wise man. Unculus realized at the beginning of that pasuk, it says Hashem appeared to Yaakov in a dream. Now let me ask you a question. Okay, this happened to me the other night. Who here has a dream about monsters? I didn't have the dream about monsters. I have kids who have dreams about monsters. Okay, do monsters really exist? No. I actually tried convincing my kids that monsters do exist. Apparently that was a bad call, because that night they had dreams about monsters. But nonetheless, so my daughter's in my bed. She's telling me very vivid detail. For those who know my daughter, it's not unrelatable. Very vivid detail about the monsters that came to her in the middle of the night. Monsters aren't real. How can it exist in my daughter's dream? The answer is, they're dreams. Anything could happen in a dream. Right? That's the beauty of a dream. So says the Rambam, Unculus was very wise. Can God come down? God can't come down. God doesn't have legs. That's why it bothers Unculus everywhere else. But in your dreams, can God come down?
Yes.
Unculus says, of course, anything could happen in a dream. Dreams don't have to be real. Okay? And that's how the Rambam interprets this. Okay? Now I share this with you, A, to show why the Rambam believes Unculus stays away from explaining right from God's corporeality, because he thinks that creates problems, that creates theological problems. But I also want to give you a glimpse into the status that the Rambam gives Unculus. Calls him a distinguished man, very wise, very understanding, etc., etc., etc. Okay? That is the Rambam. And you can, the Rambam's in English, you can all go on. Okay, that's number one. Number two, we have Rashi. Rashi says it is to protect God. And it's, again, this is similar to the Rambam. But if you look on page 7. So the pasuk says, this is a famous pasuk 4. Atem risem asher asisim Mitzrayim, you have seen what I did in Egypt. Ve'esah eschem al kanfei nesharim, I've carried you on the wings of eagles. Ve'avi eschem elai, and I brought you to me. Can a non-physical being bring someone else to them? No, that's impossible. God doesn't have, right? God isn't limited by physical space. God doesn't occupy any space. So how can God bring us to him? That is a challenge to God. Right, that implies that God isn't what we think he is, here, there, and everywhere. In fact, he can't be here, there, and everywhere. He's nowhere, because he's God. Just in case I've confused all of you. Okay? But says Targum, if you look on the bottom, all the way on the bottom of that right-hand column, where I have a bracket, says Rashi, Ve'avi eschem elai, I brought you to me, kitargumo. Rashi says, you know what, who's right? Unculus' interpretation's right. What does Unculus say? So instead of reading it in the Unculus, if you look in footnote 7, okay, Unculus says, "Vikarevit yaschon lepalchani," which means I brought you close to my worship. Okay, again, why does Unculus retranslate as not "I brought you to me," but that "I brought you close to my worship"? One implies a physical characteristic of God, and one does not. And in fact, if you look in the footnote, it continues on. It does not mean that he brought them close to him in terms of their location, or in the sense of their being under his dominion, for his presence extends to all places and his rule to all men. Says Rashi, Unculus sometimes retranslates and repurposes our psukim to protect God, because we don't want to minimize God. We don't want to undermine God's greatness by limiting him to a time or a space or a place. Okay? And lastly, Unculus was a Kabbalist. This is the Ramban. The Ramban, if you turn your page to page number 8. I am not going to do the entire Ramban. I'm not going to do any of the Ramban. I gave you the Ramban in English. And what the Ramban does is tear apart the Ramban. Tear apart Maimonides Mor Nevuchim. Again, you can read it and study it on your own. He says, I refuse to accept that what the Rambam says in Mor Nevuchim is correct. Okay? And I excerpt this, believe it or not. Okay? The Ramban goes on for pages and pages and pages. It's one of the longer Rambans in the Torah. You could read what I excerpt. I put numbers by the important parts if you want to look at it in your own. But turn to page 11, the last page of your source sheet. After literally thousands upon thousands of words, with the sole purpose of tearing the Ramban to shreds, the Ramban is still left with why Onkelos so oftentimes de-emphasizes God's physical characteristics. And he writes the following, where I have the number 8. Aval ha'inyanim ha'eilo le'onkelos ve'yonasan ben Uziel. Dvarim yiduim ve'kabbalah v'sodam le'yodin chen. Says the Ramban, you want to know why Onkelos does this? Because it is a Kabbalistic tradition whose secret is known to only a select few. That stinks, right? That's not fun. That's not a good reason. But that's what Ramban says. Ramban says, forget the Rambam's interpretation, forget Rashi, none of that's true. He said the Onkelos understood Kabbalah. Onkelos understood through Kabbalistic reasons that he put these words in, and each one, and by the way, if you look even in the art scroll, it's very interesting. We'll just read it, because it's right, the paragraph after I ended. He says, Ramban continues with an explanation based on Kabbalah, in which he accounts for some variations of Onkelos' translation and for Onkelos' anomalous rendering of our verse. In the Hebrew text, the balance of Ramban's discussion of this matter, which we leave untranslated, appears in the paragraphs. In other words, Ramban is going to go on for paragraphs and paragraphs. Article says, we have no clue what the Ramban's talking about. Ramban's talking about Kabbalah, we don't know from Kabbalah. You're going to learn Kabbalah, because your senior rabbi is turning a certain age next week, and I believe at that age, one is allowed to learn Kabbalah, and so you might be learning a lot of Kabbalah in the next couple of weeks. In fact, the old shul I was in, so when the rabbi there turned 40, he decided, Rabbi Gober's not going to really learn Kabbalah. He's going to discuss whether one's allowed to learn Kabbalah at 40. Not that I'm giving away Rabbi Gober's age. But the old shul, so the rabbi decided he was going to learn Kabbalah. And literally for months, every drusha, every shir was like Kabbalistic ideas. And finally, the shul just like had enough. They're like, we have no clue what you're talking about. Learn Kabbalah on your own. Don't share it with us, right? So again, some people get into it a little bit more. But art school clearly wanted to avoid the whole thing. Yeah.
Couldn't this also be a factor, could the rise of Christianity be a factor in this avoiding the anthropomorphization of God? Rejecting the idea that God has a physical form.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's what that's the Ramban, that's Rashi. In other words, to protect God, to avoid mistakes, means that you can't look at the Torah and make mistakes as a result of it and misunderstand the Torah. You can't assume that God is a physical being if I reinterpret it as his utterance, as his glory, as his divine providence, etc. So yes, exactly. Okay. Number whatever. Explains the significance of metaphors in the Torah. I'll give you one example. When Moshe is doing all of the miracles in Egypt, the pasuk says, "Vayichazek Adonais leiv Paro Melech Mitzrayim vayirdof acharei bnei Yisrael." I'm sorry, this is B'shalach when they're leaving. "Uvnei Yisrael yotzim biyad rama." And the Jewish people, the Israelites, left with a yad rama. Literally translates yad is a, and rama means high. What does that mean? If they left with a high hand, but they're all walking like this, like doing Zumba as they left, right? They were slapping each other high five. What does that mean? It's a metaphor. What?
They left with their heads held high.
That's not what the pasuk says. So how do I know that? I know that because Gersh must have learned his Onkelos, or he cheated, right? Because the pasuk says, according to Onkelos, Uvnei Yisrael, Nafkin, Beresh Gali, with a bare head. Okay, which means ostentatiously, openly, bare head, right? Ostentatious means that they didn't leave like this, but they left like this, proudly, right? Bare head. In other words, they left openly. Okay? So again, Onkelos there is taking a metaphor in the Torah, a metaphor which honestly makes very little sense to us. And if for those people in the world who would understand Aramaic, he opens that metaphor up and explains what the pasuk is trying to communicate. He explains the prophetic content of biblical poetry. This is actually one of my cooler examples. Okay, now you'll notice the color of the pasuk. You tell me what the... you tell me... This was better, by the way. Right? You tell me what this pasuk means. This is a pasuk by who? Who's this pasuk talking about? This is Yehuda. This is the bracha that Yaakov gives to Yehuda. And he says in the bracha, Osri la gefen iro vilasregab b'ni asono. Art scroll translates it. He ties his he donkey to the vine, to the branch, his she donkeys fall. What magnificent pasuk in the Torah. How relevant and meaningful to my life. How transformational and inspirational. I have no clue what that is. That we might as well put Chinese up there for me. Okay? So what is this? It's poetry, right? All of Yaakov's brothers are poetry. Poetry is written not to be understood easily. So we don't understand what's going on. Listen to what Unculus does. He writes, Yischar Yisrael lekarte ama yivnon heichalek. So that means nothing to us either. So you'll notice I matched up green, yellow, pink, blue, and red. This was, took my daughter a long time to fall asleep last night, right? But I'll give you it, I'll do it on your bed, okay? Yis Osrei Geffen, Geffen means vine, grapevine, throughout Tanakh, specifically in Sefer Yirmiyah. I actually wrote a whole paper on this in high school. The Jewish people are compared to a vine, grapes are the choicest of the fruits. So you have the Jewish people. He interchanges those two. Iro means, and here means he donkey. Here it's going to mean, karte means Yerushalayim. Where do we see this? In Smiros. What do we say? Karte to Yerushalayim. Right? Karte means the city of Yerushalayim. Okay? Velasreka means Amma, means the Jewish people. And again, if you look in the pasuk in the Torah, Rashi actually quotes Unculus, and Rashi explains this even a little bit better. I mean, he explains how Unculus matches each word up. Bini, which means my children, or, right, that's how I would think it would mean. So Bini is also Binya. So Yivnon. Yivnon means Bnei, they will build. And Asono, he points out from a pasuk in Yechezkel, that Shar Aton refers to the Beis HaMikdash. And therefore Atono means his temple. All Unculus has done is taken these random words, which mean nothing to us, put together. He finds other places in Tanakh where they have an alternate meaning, uses that alternate meaning in his Aramaic translation, and when you piece it together, you get the following translation of our pasuk. He will bring Israel from around to a city, the nation who will build his temple. That makes a lot more sense than he ties his he donkey to the vine, to the branch his she donkey's foot. Okay, so what Unculus has done is he's taken a poetic pasuk in the Torah that is totally blind to us, totally hidden from us. And piecing together words from around the Torah and Tanakh, he pieced it together in Aramaic, using the Aramaic words. You have your grid here to understand it, and you put together a pasuk that gives you a little insight into who Yehuda is. Yehuda is going to bring everyone together to the Beis HaMikdash. Okay. Next. Unculus tries to prevent Chil Hashem. This comes back to what you were just talking about. Right? Psukim can oftentimes be misconstrued, can be misused. I'll give you an example. The word Mizbeach. What does the word Mizbeach mean?
Altar.
Is altar a religious context or a non-religious context? I found that out. Religious, right? Mizbeach. There's one problem. It's also used in an irreligious context. So we'll give you an example. Number one, Vayiven Noach Mizbeach Lashem, holy or unholy context. Holy. Pasuk in Vayikra. Ki es Mizbecho Sam Titotsu, Ves Matsevo Sam Tishaberu. It's not Vayikra, excuse me. Right? What if this is talking about the nations of the world, Et Mizbechotam, their altars, Titotsu, Ved Matsevo Tam Tishaberu, you should destroy them and break them. Okay, now it's the same word used in very different contexts. One is used to represent something holy. One is used to reflect something that should be destroyed. How do I know the difference? Context. Well, context can be abused and manipulated. And so watch what Unculus does in his translation. By the Mizbeach that's holy, he uses the word Mitbecha, Matbecha. By the word Mizbeach that's not holy, Ego Rehom. And this is throughout Tanakh. Unculus will do this. He'll use different these two different words from Mizbeach, depending on whether the word Mizbeach is talking about a Mizbeach to Hashem, or whether it's talking about a Mizbeach of idolatry. Why does he do that? He does that to leave nothing to chance, that anyone can misuse the word and say, see, you're supposed to break God's altars. You're supposed to go to the Beis HaMikdash and destroy the altar. Unculus says, that's not. Don't you get it? It's a totally different word. Okay, I'll give you another example. The word Elohim. What does the word Elohim mean? God. Okay? God, our God, capital G, or God, lowercase g? It could be both. It's used both in Tanakh. It's very confusing in Tanakh, actually. And so you'll notice that in Unkelus' translation, what does he do? Vayechal Elohim b'yom ha'shvim lavto asher asa v'yivarech Elohim es yom ha'shvi. He changes the word Elohim to Yudke Vavke. Yudke Vavke can only refer to what type of God? The capital G God, our God. So again, Unkelus does that to avoid anyone misusing the name Elohim and misunderstanding Tanakh, misrepresenting it. Next one, he strives to maintain the dignity of our forefathers. Pasuk says, Vayomer ba'achicha b'mirma v'yikach b'rchasecha. Talking about who? Yaakov. Right? That when Esau comes, Yitzchak says, oh, your brother came b'mirma. B'mirma means sneaky, cunningly. Basically, your brother lied. Well, Unkelus doesn't allow that. Can't say that Yaakov lied. That creates the lot, right? Our avos are supposed to be perfect. And so therefore, what does he say? Changes the word b'mirma to b'chachma. B'chachma does not mean he cheated. What does it mean? He outsmarted you. Next. Precious. This was which parsha? Right? The one we just read. The love on Allah l'gzoz it so no. Lazan goes to sheep to shear the sheep. Vatignov Rachel atatrafim asher laviyah. Rachel, what did she do? Ganav? She stole. How can Rachel steal? Aren't our emo supposed to be perfect? So again, Unkelus translates it, v'nisbet, v'nisabet, which means, and she took. Stealing and taking are two very different things. Okay? Another example. Vayitein lo asnat bat potifera kohen on li'isha. Talking about who? Yosef. Yosef marries who? A nice Jewish girl from Boca Raton? No, who does Yosef marry? Osnat bat Potifera. Osnat, daughter of Potiphar. Are you shepherding nachas for Yosef right now or not? No, that's a real problem. That's a real problem. How does Yosef at Sadi, marries non-Jewish women? So listen to what Unkelus does. V'yehav le yas osnat bat Potifera rabad de'on. What does the word rabah mean? What does it mean? Rabbah mean it's the great one, the esteemed one, right? In other words, don't think Yosef married down. Yosef married the creme de la creme. Again, it's protecting the integrity of our most. Does the exact same thing by who? Who else marries a quote-unquote non-Jew? Moshe Yisro was Kohen Midian. Same exact word. So again, what does he do? Same exact thing. Rabbah de Midian. He retranslates Kohen as Rabbah, that he was a great person. He was a tzaddik. Again, protecting the integrity of our avos and imos. And lastly, Targum in Halacha. Remember I said that oftentimes Unkelus will incorporate Halacha into his explanation. I'll give you four examples. Example number one. Pasuk in Bereishis says, Shofech dam adam be'adam damo yishafech ki betzelem elokim asas adam. Prohibition against murder. Can I kill someone for murdering someone else? In the time of the Gemara. Yeah, of course. That's right. We have many masechtas about it. What do I need to kill someone? You got to warn them. You need witnesses. You need a lot of criteria. So again, what does Unkelus add in? He says, Deshu Dema Anasha. Dema, blood, Anasha's people. If you spill the blood of people, Bisadin Al-Meymar Dayana Demei Itashad. What is Bisadin Al-Meymar Dayana? Through judges. In other words, he's incorporating the halachos of our judicial system into his commentary. I'll give you a better example. Pasuk says, Lo Svashel Gedib Echalei Bimo. Literally translates as,
you cannot cook the meat, the Lo Svashel Gedib goat, Echalei Bimo.
What do we learn out from that? Can't cook meat and milk. The halacha is a bas mechalot. How do I get one from the other? So the Gemara tells me. Listen to what Unkelus does. Lo techlun basar bechalav. In his translation, he does not translate it literally. He incorporates the halacha into his interpretation. I'll give you another example. This is a famous one. The pasuk by Sfiras Omer says, "Usfartem lachem mimacharat haShabbat," that you start counting from the day after Shabbos. What's the day after Shabbos? Sunday. This was the famous machlokas between the Sadducees and the Pharisees, the Sadducim and the Prushim. The Sadducim says that no matter when Pesach happens, you always start counting the Omer that Sunday. And the Prushim say, no, Mimacharat HaShabbat refers to which day? The day after Yontif, the second day of Pesach. Listen to what Unkelus says. V'timnon lechon mibatar Yom HaTova. Mibatar means after Yom HaTova, the day after Yontif, which is, again, our halacha. In his translation, he incorporates what the halacha is. Again, why is he doing it? To make sure Pesukim aren't misunderstood. To teach people through interpretation. The last example, Pasuk in Shmos, Vayulato Laos Al Yadcha Ulatotafos Bein Einecha. What's this talking about? What mitzvah? Tefillin. Ulatotafot Bein Einecha. How do I know Totafot means tefillin? Because the Gemara tells me Totafot means tefillin. So Unkelus in his translation says, Vayula at al yadcha filit tfilin bein einecha. Again, he incorporates the halacha into his translation. What is Unkelus' legacy? What is Unkelus' legacy? This is from the Gaon of Sar Shalom of Sura. Says the following. Other translations do not have the holiness that this Targum does. That's a misprint. What? I know. We have heard in the name of the ancient scholars that the Holy One, blessed be He, did a great thing with Unkelus the proselyte in having the Targum written by him. And so we see, even in the time of the Gaonim, Unkelus was recognized as head and shoulders above the else. We also see, the Rambam in his Mor Neruchim quotes him 22 times. Not only does he quote Unkelus 22 times, we saw from the source I quoted you, he doesn't just quote him. He refers to him in glowing terms. Rambam respected Unkelus. Rashi quotes Unkelus over 400 times in his Peirush on the Torah, more than any other Peirush in all of the Peirushim. Okay? Unkelus is also used by Aruch, which is Rashi's Rebbe, Rashbam, Radak, Ramban, Rabbeinu Bachya, Pri Etz Chaim. Why do I quote Pri Etz Chaim? No one here has probably ever heard of it. Pri Etz Chaim is a prominent Kabbalistic sefer. So I want to show you that he's not just used by other commentaries, but he's also used in Kabbalistic svarim. And again, there are many other examples, none of which you would have recognized. But just to give you an example, he was also used by Kabbal. And last but not least, the greatest point of Unkelus' legacy is the Gemara in Brachos, which has brought down halacha l'maisa. The Gemara says, Amar of Huna bar Yehuda, Amar of Ami, La'olam Yashliv Adam Parshiosavi Matzibor, Shnayim Mikrav Echad Targum. There is a halacha that every single week a person is supposed to finish Shnayim Mikra, which means the Torah twice, the Echad Targum, with the explanation once. Okay? Now the halacha says you're really supposed to use Targum Unkelus. So you're supposed to read a pasuk, reread the pasuk, and then read the pasuk with Targum Unkelus. Okay? Some people do this to this day. Others, and Mishabur talks about it, you can interchange Targum with Rashi, which is more relatable to us. Okay? And that's in fact what millions and thousands of people do. They finish the Parsha every week, Shnayim Mikra Ve'echa Targum, which means they read every Pasuk twice, and an explanation. Why do they do that? Because the end of the Gemara, Shekola Mashlin Parsha Yosav Im HaTzibor, everyone who does that, Ma'arichin Lo Yama V'Shanosav, you have a long life. You want Arichas Yamim, you want a long life? Shnayim Mikra Ve'echa Targum. Shnayim Mikra Ve'echa Targum. Shouldn't the Gemara said Shnayim Mikra Ve'echad Rashi, Shnayim Mikra Ve'echad Ramban, Shnayim Mikra Ve'echad Radak? It says Targum. Targum is the one parish used in the Gemara. That if you're going to learn one translation, you should learn Targum Unkelos. Okay, so we started off, I think that's my last slide. Right, we started off today with a brief explanation of why Targum, what is the genesis of Targum, the problems with explanation, how explanation inherently loses something, how it, by definition, is a commentary. We learned who Unkelos was, both scholarly perspective and the Gemara perspective, and then we learned seven identifying characteristics of Unkelos, everything from the anthropomorphization of God, to explaining poetry, to incorporating halacha, to simple translations. And there you have, in a nutshell, who Unkelos was and what he represents. Everyone have a fantastic